And you're very welcome along to this week's OTB NFL. We're going to be speaking with Ciarán Fahey a little bit later on. But first, our guest this week is Sam Monson. Sam, how are you doing?
I'm doing good. How about you, Jerry?
Yeah, very well. We've got the sound through live and clear this time. There's loads to talk about after last weekend and a full slate of games to look forward to this weekend as well. A couple of things that we wanted to talk about maybe first off was some of the young quarterbacks. The scene afterwards where Hugh Jackson makes the effort to try and cozy up to Baker Mayfield has been the subject of many blogs and many hot takes in the interim. I think one of the takeaways that you can make from it is that Baker feels like maybe he's better served away from the cautious nature of Hugh Jackson, and he's emerging fully fledged as a grown bird, ready to fly the nest himself.
Yeah, it was kind of interesting right after the game. Not only that Baker kind of interaction, but when Demaryius Randall intercepted a pass, ran to the sideline, handed the ball straight to Hugh Jackson after picking it off as well. So there were a couple of Browns players kind of taking, you know, shots or interesting interactions with Hugh during the course of that game. And it is that kind of interesting dynamic because you've got a guy, Hugh Jackson, who's still being paid by the Browns, having been fired by him, rocks up to a division rival and takes a job immediately with them. It doesn't appear to have sat well with his former players. And for Baker Mayfield, I think he's right. You know, he was not being helped by the play calling earlier on in the season. And that wasn't all Hugh Jackson. Obviously, Todd Haley was the guy calling the plays there. And there were a lot of these terrible situations, terrible plays that basically just set Baker Mayfield up in third and long and asked him to deliver time after time. And that's pretty tough going. And it has improved since the coaching switches. And I think Baker Mayfield, regardless, has looked really well. He's looked good earlier in the season despite being hamstrung by the play calling. And he's looked good as things have gone on, when it's been a little better and has led to the overall offense looking better. But I think either way, the news is fantastic for the Cleveland Browns because it looks like they finally have a quarterback. They finally have one that they've been searching for basically since they came back into existence back in 1999.
It must be legitimately one of the few times ever that you're able to say something like this, but it is a very exciting job, the head coaching job at the Cleveland Browns, because not alone do you have a quarterback, you've got a running back, you've got some wide receiver, tight end talent, you have pass rush, you have a cornerback, you've got a lot of pieces there. And as far as I know, you've still got a massive amount of money that you can spend in the salary cap next year. So notwithstanding the fact they're probably going to have a decent pick as well, unless they absolutely run the table from this point. But at the same time, it's a very exciting job, right?
Well, not just that, but you get to be the guy that takes credit for rejuvenating, you know, one of the great storied franchises and one of the most kind of pitiful disasters in the NFL over the past 25 years. You know, you get to be the guy that says that fixes all of that. You get the guy that gets the credit for it. I think that's why you see people like Bruce Arians, you know, former Cardinals head coach, saying, "The only job I'm interested in taking if I come out of retirement is the Cleveland Browns job." I think people legitimately want to be the guy that gets seen as turning that all around, even if much of the groundwork was done before they ever got in the building. But you're right, that it's an exciting opportunity right now. The single biggest thing is the quarterback. You know, that's the hardest thing to get right if you're trying to fix a franchise. If you don't have a quarterback, nothing else matters until you do. And if you do have a quarterback, everything becomes so much easier. It's you know, look what the Colts have done with Andrew Luck for years. They've had pretty terrible rosters, and he's been taking that team to the playoffs, and it papers over all kinds of cracks. You just don't appreciate how bad everything else is when he's not there until he goes down hurt and you see what a disaster it is. You know, Baker Mayfield is the equivalent of that for the Cleveland Browns. He is able to make everything look a lot better. So if you get in the door right now as the new head coach, there's already a decent amount of talent around him. But even if you do a terrible job from this point on, Baker Mayfield is going to make you look pretty good.
Yeah, and if you're the owner slash GM at the moment looking at the trends around the league, Bruce Arians might not be the worst idea. Somebody who has a track record of offense, of knowing how to get the best out of quarterbacks, and certainly in even reclamation projects when this isn't a reclamation project anymore. But would he be maybe a bit of a left field perfect choice?
Bruce Arians has this interesting offensive system that doesn't, it flies in the face of what everybody else is doing right now. So you look at the league generally, and everybody's going to these spread systems. They're going horizontal across the field. They're getting as many wide receivers out into patterns as possible. And everything's going to the quick game. You look at Andrew Luck and this Frank Reich influence, and he's getting the ball out of his hand faster than he's ever done it before. You know, Tom Brady and the Patriots have been doing this for years. Drew Brees has the lowest average depth of target of his career right now this season. He's playing at an MVP level. Cam Newton's average depth of target had come down like 3 yards with Norv Turner's system. And Norv Turner is another guy who would have been traditionally a more vertically inclined offense. But every time Arians shows up, his quarterbacks lead the league in average depth of target. You think those Arizona guys, Carson Palmer, Drew Stanton, who's a backup in Cleveland right now, but those guys always lead the league in average depth of target. And it does create some really exciting offense, but it's obviously high risk, high reward. You also create a lot of turnover-worthy plays in that system. And it only really clicked in Arizona when Carson Palmer had this unsustainably freakish season in terms of limiting the mistakes. He just didn't make a lot of bad decisions. And obviously all the big plays were still there. So suddenly you got this MVP caliber season out of Carson Palmer until he got hurt and had a complete disaster meltdown in the playoffs. But I think the league is going away from the style of offense that Arians runs. And the more it does that, the more concerning I think it is to run as a system. It just looks too high risk when you can get the same kind of thing done in other ways.
Are there names out there that you've seen linked with the job that you think, yeah, that's exactly the right candidate?
Not yet. I think there's always the kind of hot offensive coordinator candidates that come along every year. At some point, somebody is going to give Josh McDaniels another head coaching job. Obviously, there was that saga last season of how he basically, bait and switched the Indianapolis Colts and then went back to the Patriots. But
they're pretty happy with that now.
I'm sure they are. Yeah, it's worked out well. Honestly, it's worked out well for both franchises, and it's going to put a lot of people off Josh McDaniels, but the same way you can't turn an NFL team off a player with talent almost regardless of what he does. You know, I'm thinking of Reuben Foster here. The same thing's true for coaching talent. You know, a guy can piss off a lot of people, but somebody's going to give him a shot because they need a head coach, and he'll be a good candidate.
Yeah, it did seem like he'd kind of been given the nod, though, that the Patriots gig is his whenever eventually Bill Belichick decides. I don't know if Bill Belichick's ever going to retire. He might well die in that job at 84. So, I mean, maybe that was all just a bottle of smoke that they sold him to stay there. And maybe it was just a load more money, and that was enough. So, who knows? But I guess somebody like that would actually work very well. The Harbaughs, both of them have actually been linked with this job. And 3 weeks ago, you would have thought, well, I can definitely see Baltimore moving on from John Harbaugh at this point because, well, let's face it, everybody's bored watching the same thing that they've done for, well, forever since they've had Flacco. And then Lamar Jackson comes in and he runs 600 times in his first week and he runs far less in his second week but starts to throw the ball and makes some mistakes but actually looks like an NFL quarterback. And you're like, Maybe Joe Flacco's on the market here in return for a second or third round pick.
Yeah, I think Lamar Jackson has the capability of saving John Harbaugh's job in that regard. You know, it felt like that was going the way that it did way back when Denver fired Mike Shanahan, you know, and he was still doing well. He still had that team in contention every single year. But they were no longer Super Bowl contenders. They were just playoff contenders. And eventually, people just get kind of fed up of that. They just go, you know what? There's no progression here. We're not getting better. We're just at the same level every single year. And even if you can do a hell of a lot worse than that level, we're just sick of it. So we're moving on. And Denver eventually moved on from Mike Shanahan. They brought in Josh McDaniels, and it was a total train wreck. It was an absolute disaster. And the Ravens kind of felt like they were going the same way. It's okay, we're at the same level every single year, and it's a pretty decent level, but we're not winning a Super Bowl anytime soon under you. So we may be thinking about moving on. But Lamar Jackson might be the reason to stave that off. He brings that excitement back. He brings you something that they might not have with Joe Flacco, which is the capability of being something better than they are right now. So he would be an interesting guy because, like the Mike Shanahan thing, I think that is always a harsh way of kind of seeing these coaches of, you know, you can do so much worse than a guy who is at a consistently playoff contending level every single year, that if that guy moves to a new environment, it could be a huge thing. And for Flacco, yeah, he could find himself on the trade block. I just don't know if anyone's going to want to trade that much for him because he's not very good at the moment. He hasn't been very good for a number of years now.
Isn't there a team in Jacksonville who would bite your hand off for the mediocrity that is Joe Flacco versus what they've had to suffer through for the last 3 years? Having said that, it's very possible that the Jags end up being so bad this year that they get such a high draft pick, they'll have their pick of QBs in the draft next year.
Right. I mean, the Jags are going to draft a new quarterback. Obviously, the Blake Bortles experiment has been a complete mess. In order for Blake Bortles to have any kind of success within that offense, they basically had to make the offense idiot-proof to the point where any quarterback could do it. And to the point where if that was the plan, I have no earthly idea why they weren't starting Cody Kessler, who is far less likely to make an idiotic decision and turn the ball over. He may not have the big plays in his arsenal that Blake Bortles has, but if your entire MO is to make the offense idiot-proof and just have a quarterback that doesn't screw it up, he's a way better option than Blake Bortles is to do that kind of thing. So, yeah, the Jags system has been a mess. You know, I posted a Twitter a video of Blake Bortles. I've never encountered a quarterback before where the guy fundamentally forgets how to throw a ball. I don't mean like inaccurately. I mean the ball will come out end over end. It's like he forgets how to throw a spiral.
It's like an Irish person throwing a spiral.
Exactly. And I compared it to Conor McGregor, the throw that we saw from him where he went to the Dallas Cowboys and just pitched this thing and it looked ridiculous. I compared it to that, and actually Conor McGregor tweeted back about it, which I didn't see coming. But like that's what it looks like. And if you ever have to go into a game and before the game internally ask the question, what happens if Blake forgets how to throw the ball in the course of this game? Like, that's a bad situation to be in. Most of the time you're dealing with, you know, what happens if they change up the coverages, they start disguising things, blah, blah, blah. But if you have to ever ask the question, what happens if our quarterback fundamentally forgets how to throw the ball? And that's happened at least 3 times in the past couple of seasons.
I have some recollection of him talking about him trying to improve his mechanics over the summer, 2 summers ago, where he was actually pretty much putting it out there that he doesn't throw the ball very well and that he needed to go and relearn that. And it was one of the first times that I can ever remember somebody who's an elite athlete getting paid millions and millions who coming out and saying, I actually don't really know how to do my job very well, but I'm going to continue trying my best.
Right. I mean, he gets the yips the same way, you know, golfers do, where they just something has happened and they literally can't hit the ball for an indeterminate amount of time. And that happens in games for Blake Bortles. I've never seen that happen to another NFL quarterback.
Which was worse for your mentions, Brady's in decline or Conor McGregor having a go?
Oh, no, Conor McGregor having a go is fine. I got a couple of random Conor McGregor fanboys tweeting me. That's always going to happen. But that was actually that was more novelty value. The Brady thing a few years ago, the first time, the Brady thing, that was, so I'd kind of taken pride up until that point of never having blocked anybody on Twitter. It sort of felt to me like, you know, you don't need to block people. That's like a sign of weakness. And then like 12 hours into the Brady thing, I was like, to hell with this. I'm just blocking everybody that comes at me with that. So, yeah, that was a fun watershed day on Twitter, the Brady thing.
Yeah, there you go. Just to go back to the Harbaughs, because I did see that there was the University of Michigan were scouting a player in Ohio, and it would have been very easy for a meeting to happen between Jim Harbaugh, and the brass at the Browns. And then everybody's like, well, the family are really from there. They all grew up as Browns fans. Certainly their ma was anyway. He's a QB. Is there any chance that somebody like Harbaugh is tempted back from Michigan where, you know, he seems to be on a contract for life of immense amounts of money, even though he's doing an okay job? Is that a possibility? Like, is that not your retirement job where you get there and go, this is amazing?
Yeah, I mean, I think there is a possibility, but it would take a lot to make it happen. You know, you're talking monster sums of money. You're talking probably unreasonable levels of control. You know, you're going to have to deal with the fact that John Dorsey is already installed as GM, and there's a limit to how much power you can give somebody like Jim Harbaugh. You can't bring him in and offer him complete personnel control because that's already there. in the hands of somebody else, he would be coming in to be a head coach, and that alone. So there would be a lot of hurdles to clear. It doesn't feel like a great marriage to me, and you would be leaning on this idea of Jim Harbaugh feeling like he has unfinished business at the NFL level. And, you know, who knows how much that's worth to him, but that would be the thing that would be needed to have a major part of this happening if it did happen.
Yeah, I'd quite like to see him back in that job. I can see that working as well. It does feel like Lamar is saving the Baltimore Harbaugh, and that actually that's going to be an interesting marriage as well, because they will always be good on defense. And if you add a completely different threat who might be able to throw and evolve his throwing over the next while, then they're actually a pretty good team to watch. Is it too late in the season for them to have an impact in the playoffs, do you think?
No, I think it's actually the right time, because, you know, these new quarterbacks that have something unique about their game are typically effective right off the bat before teams figure out how to deal with them. You know, we saw that with guys like Colin Kaepernick, and they get this kind of honeymoon period, and then eventually teams work out where their weaknesses are, if they're not developing a specific area of the game, and how to attack them. Like, Lamar Jackson has had this gimmick package all the way through the season, but now we're seeing him as an NFL quarterback, and it's going to take teams a while to figure out how to best bottle him up and how to best contain him. And it might be that it takes them longer than they're going to have this season. The Ravens actually have that advantage up to the playoffs and into the playoffs if they make it that far. What's going to be fascinating for them is, what can Lamar Jackson become? Because week one was almost the typical Lamar Jackson game, except you didn't get the big plays with his arms. We saw, obviously, they ran him an absolute ton. He made a few decent plays passing the ball in terms of escaping pressure, delivering the ball to somebody. We saw a few ugly passes as well, but we didn't see the big play that typically comes off the back of all that running threat. Last week, we saw that. We saw, you know, one of the biggest plays he had was negated by a holding penalty, but it was the perfect example. Deep down the sideline, perfect pass. He has those plays in his arsenal. His issue is consistency. It's not that he can't pass the ball. It's not that he isn't a good passer. It's that he isn't a good passer all the time. And when he isn't a good passer, it's ugly. But what the running threat does is it creates, or it's what it certainly did at Louisville, is it creates this incredible play action game where you're able to fake runs, drop back to pass, and it opens up these massive wide open spaces deep down the field, because you've just spent, you spent two drives terrifying people that he's going to take off and run. So safeties get moved out of the way, linebackers fire up, and you open up these yawning chasms in the middle of the field. And at that point, it doesn't matter that he's a particularly inaccurate quarterback, because he has so much space to work with. You know, a guy that was typically a yard of separation is now 10 yards into open space, and anybody can hit him. It doesn't matter if you're accurate or not. So what is going to be fascinating to see is if that continues at the NFL level, if NFL defenses are disciplined enough to be able to respect the threat he brings as a running quarterback and as a guy who can do damage underneath without sacrificing these wide open receivers deep down the field the way college defenses did.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting to see that some of the teams were surging at the moment. The Seahawks are winning close games. There was a couple of weeks back where they lost a game at home, but they lost it, and in the last play to win the game, or maybe it was to tie it up, Russell Wilson had a receiver open in the end zone, the receiver drops the pass, and everybody goes, oh, well, maybe that's the Seahawks, it's not going to be their year. But week after week since then, he's been having game-winning drives and has that team playing at a level where, I don't know, I mean, the job that... So Pete Carroll's getting talked about as a potential coach of the year, or he at least should be in the conversation for coach of the year given the job that he's doing. But when you think about what Russell Wilson has had to deal with over the course of this year, most of his best players have been injured at one point or another. He finds a tight end, that tight end goes on IR two games later, having kind of gone, oh, great. And then a running back comes in, does well for 2 weeks, and he goes out injured. The next guy comes up and is like, oh, it's actually not too bad. And he goes out injured. And they've had a committee of people. And yet all the time, he has been dangerous, either passing or running, and has been very, very accurate.
Yeah, I think the Seahawks, if they make the playoffs, will be one of the most dangerous teams in there. I would not want to play the Seahawks in the playoffs, pretty much if I'm anybody in the NFC. And that includes the Rams. You know, the Seahawks have played the Rams close twice this season in shootout games, which is not what you expect from the Seahawks. But they, you know, the Rams would be happy to take on a bunch of teams in the NFC. I don't think they'd be happy to play the Seahawks. What's really fascinating about the Seahawks team, I thought that what was going to happen was they would end up just missing out on the playoffs, basically because they had to play the Rams twice, you know, two defeats. But this past week against the Panthers may have changed that. That was a game that they probably weren't supposed to win, that they ended up stealing a march on the rest of the NFC by winning that game and actually putting themselves in a decent position to make the postseason because of that. And what's ironic with Wilson is that, yeah, he's had to deal with a lot of injuries, and his receivers have been a problem and going down left, right, and center. But the offensive line this year is so much better than it's been basically throughout the entirety of his career. He has had one of the worst offensive lines every single season of his career, the worst offensive line basically over the entirety of his career. This year, it's different. It's really been different since they traded for Dwayne Brown at left tackle halfway through last season. But they're in a completely different stratosphere this season when it comes to pass protection. They have, I think, the 12th best pass blocking efficiency score at PFF, which is basically a per snap measure of how much pressure you're giving up with some weighting towards sacks. They've only allowed the fourth fewest total pressures allowed almost always since he's been in the league. They've been 30th to 32nd in those categories. They've been disastrous. Now, Wilson still invites a lot of pressure on himself because of the way he plays the game. But for the first time maybe ever in his career, he doesn't have to assume it's coming. You know, every single snap, he doesn't have to worry about the pressure that's bearing down on him inevitably if he holds the ball. For the first time, he actually has a platform to play with, and then he can decide, you know, when he wants to bail from a pocket and when he wants to sort of invite pressure on himself. But I think that's really showing or paying dividends. You're seeing a Russell Wilson that's devastatingly effective and is still one of the most dangerous passers in the NFL.
It's a bit mad that when, like, Tom Cable was sacked at the start of the season and apparently was very good friends with Pete Carroll, and he was the offensive line coach. And it is a bit mad how one position coach is creating this block for the whole team. Like, I mean, it's obviously not as straightforward as that. You can't put it all on Tom Cable, but you can put some of it on Tom Cable.
You can, and I don't think it's a coincidence that Tom Cable has gone from Seattle, who had the worst offensive line in the NFL, to Oakland, and now Oakland's offensive line has kind of gone to hell. When you hear offensive line coaches brought up on broadcasts and in commentary and all that kind of stuff, you will never hear a bad word said about them. It's always, this guy is one of the best in the business, and regardless of who it is. I just don't think there's any kind of knowledge about how good these guys are. And there's certainly something to be said for the fact that the Seahawks didn't exactly bless Tom Cable with, you know, elite talent when it comes to offensive line. They had a run of converting defensive linemen into offensive tackles and former basketball players and, you know, taking all kinds of crazy people and just saying, well, Tom Cable is a great offensive line coach. He'll mold these guys into stars. And it didn't happen. And consequently, they didn't really have the talent to make it happen either. So it's not all on Tom Cable, but certainly he hasn't done anything over the past few years to suggest that he's capable of turning raw, talented, and inconsistent players into quality offensive linemen. But since he's left, this whole unit has come together and has become dramatically better.
I need to talk briefly about the Bears as well, because it turns out that they've been... They're very happy with where Trubisky is, even though his stats apparently this year are not as good as last year's. When your QB goes out and you win a game, particularly against a divisional rival, that's a sign that things are cooking in your team.
Yeah, well, what's interesting about Trubisky is that his stats are fantastic. The box score numbers, his passer rating, all this kind of stuff. But his PFF grade right now is not, and hasn't been all season long. And usually when that happens, what it is it's a sign of the offensive scheme is making a guy look better than he actually is playing. So you think back to, the impact Sean McVay has had, and back when Chip Kelly hit the league and took it by storm, Nick Foles that great year, his PFF grade was never as good as the incredible numbers, because a lot of it was the Chip Kelly offense manufacturing these easy plays for him and opening up these windows. So we're kind of seeing that for Trubisky this year, that his box score numbers look fantastic, and he's doing a lot of damage on the ground with his legs, but on a play-to-play basis, he just isn't grading that well. And he has a lot of turnover-worthy plays. I think he's third in the league at that. He's only a few off the very highest guys in the NFL in terms of potentially turning the ball over. But I actually think that's great news for the Bears, because you know, you tell that to Chicago fans and you just get this wall of hate back. It's like, why are you hating our quarterback? He's doing great. We're winning games. Like, you're missing the point. This is a good thing for you because right now your scheme is clicking, your defense is clicking, and the quarterback is not playing that well. And now if he does start to play well down the stretch or into the playoffs, I mean, you're unstoppable at that point because all this other stuff is already in a great situation. The scheme is already manufacturing this incredible offense. If the quarterback actually starts to add value on top of that, then you start talking about, you know, Sean McVay and Jared Goff in Los Angeles and Andy Reid and Patrick Mahomes in Kansas City. Then you start to talk about one of the most unstoppable offenses in the NFL. So I think for the Bears, it's fantastic news. This idea that Chase Daniel was able to roll in there against a pretty good defense at times, and no, they didn't miss a beat. You know, he looked absolutely fine. Again, great news. It reinforces the idea that this is very much down to Matt Nagy's offensive scheme and the idea that there's so much more untapped potential, because if you get a quarterback that starts to play well, and Trubisky definitely has the talent to do that. We've seen that with his big plays this season. If he does start to play better than that, the Bears will be really, really tough.
There hasn't been that much blowback. I mean, there's been a bit of blowback for the Redskins' decision to sign a player who had just been cut for his third arrest, his second arrest for domestic violence at the weekend at the team hotel. I'm wondering what happens with this situation when Reuben Foster comes back, because he will come back. The NFL are going to suspend him for a certain number of games. He's still on his rookie contract. He is still a transcendent talent, although his grade this year, I suspect, wasn't particularly good compared with what it was at the end of last year. There was definitely a suggestion that he'd come down from the stratospheric right. level that he was at last year. The NFL just doesn't seem to care about this kind of stuff.
Well, it certainly doesn't care as much about this stuff as it does about other things, you know. And we've seen the idea that you can be suspended for more for a couple of failed marijuana tests than you are for domestic violence has always seemed completely ridiculous, and will remain completely ridiculous as long as they do that. But yeah, you're right. There will be a suspension. The Redskins, if they've signed him and have kind of gone this far, will probably stick by him through that suspension. It seems unlikely they would cast him off at that point, knowing that this is probably coming down the line. And the statement that they put out is kind of strange. You know, they basically said, we talked to all his former Alabama teammates. You know, they've got a stack of those guys up front on the defensive line, Jonathan Allen, Daron Payne, Ryan Anderson. They talked to those guys, and based off the conversations they had, they decided it was worth you know, signing this guy who they presumably were assured is a fantastic stand-up human being based on his former teammates. So yeah, it's you're right, the league doesn't appear to care enough about this particular problem, and as long as that's the case, it will be as at least as big of a problem, if not a bigger problem, down the line.
Sam, great stuff as ever. Thanks very much for joining us.
Anytime, Chick. Take it easy, Jer.
It's Sam Montanari. You can get him at PFF_Sam. Well, let's run you through the fixtures and the scores from last week's games. Some interesting fixtures on the slate for this week, and some interesting results from last week as well. We'll pull them up for you. So the results last week, the Thanksgiving games we've already done. The Bengals have completely fallen apart. Andy Dalton is on IR. The Browns that we were talking about there absolutely annihilated them. The 49ers, after the Reuben Foster arrest, went and got spanked by the Tampa Bay Buccaneers with Jameis Winston under center. The Bills beat the Jags in a remarkable game, 24-21. Jalen Ramsey's big mouth did not help him. A brilliant performance from Josh Allen, and Leonard Fournette suspended for this week, having gotten a fight, having run across the entire length or width of the pitch to get involved in a fight. The Ravens spanked the Raiders. The Panthers, as we've heard, beaten by the Seahawks and Russell Wilson. The Patriots took care of business against the Jets, but were not particularly brilliant in that against a fairly crappy Jets team. The Eagles beat the Giants, so that's the end of the Giants. They needed to run the table, but that keeps the Eagles just about sniffing around there, because obviously Washington have no quarterback at the moment and were beaten on Thanksgiving, and we're going to have to wait and see exactly how they recover. So Dallas obviously also charging at the moment. Speaking of charging, the Chargers, what was it, 600 consecutive completions for Philip Rivers in that game, 45-10. The Colts beat the Dolphins 27-24, much closer in the end. But, otherworldly stuff from Andrew Luck, who apparently now is in the conversation for MVP, because it couple of wins together at this stage and you're in the conversation. The Broncos, we will talk about the Broncos in a minute because they beat the Steelers 24-17 and they also are hanging around, whereas the Vikings have surely, surely finished the Packers season. And then the Texans, again, 8 consecutive victories, having had 3 consecutive defeats at the start of the season, absolutely spanking the Titans on Monday Night Football, or Lunity, as it says there. So we can take you through the fixtures this week. Move on, take a look at some of these. The Monday Night Football again is the Redskins at the Eagles, which is obviously a huge game in terms of the destination of that division. But I'm sure Dallas will be sitting there licking their chops for that one. So the Ravens at the Falcons, the Panthers at the Bucks, the Bears at the Giants, the Bills at the Dolphins, the Colts at the Jags, the Browns at the Texans, and the Broncos at the Bengals. Sorry, the Rams and the Lions and the Cardinals Packers are all early kickoffs. 9 early kickoffs on Sunday evening for us here in Ireland to watch at 6 o'clock. The Chiefs at the Raiders. Jesus, what a crap game that is. It's going to be 600-0. The Jets at the Titans. Again, don't watch any of that. The 49ers at the Seahawks. Don't watch any of that. And then it's the Vikings at the Patriots, which should be a brilliant game at 9:25 in Gillette Stadium, when the late game is also a bit of a cracker. It's the Chargers at the Steelers. And as I said, Monday Night Football is the Redskins at the Eagles. So we can move on and talk to Cian. Hey, Cian, how are you?
You sound like a broken man there, Gerard. These games wearing you down.
I just wasn't sure about how many bad games there were.
Well, it's the second half of the season. Normally you get to these backup quarterbacks like Colt McCoy and you just go into these games and Nick Mullins and random player Josh McCown is playing, and it takes away all the competitive aspects of it, and that's kind of what we have. Fortunately, I think the bye weeks are all finished now, so we've got 16 full games every week.
Yeah, I don't know if that's fortunate or unfortunate. It's kind of one of those things like, oh, okay, all these crap teams who have been off for a week or two or in a staggered couple of weeks, we're like, okay, they're all back in action this week, and we do have to pay attention, at least for fantasy purposes, to how Nick Mullins is getting on this week. I mean, I liked Nick Mullins' first game. It was sensational, but since then, turns out, anybody's good against the Raiders.
Especially on a short week at home. That's a big thing this year, where quarterbacks on short weeks at home are putting up big numbers. But hey, look, as long as there's enough games for Red Zone to be going mad for a whole Sunday night, we can't really complain.
No, it's true. Red Zone, definitely one of the greatest things in the history of mankind at this stage, helping to sedate an entire population for a whole Sunday. Come here, there's a couple of things we want to talk about. We were talking a good bit about Sam, about Lamar Jackson. What's your take on what's going on at the moment in Baltimore? Because he looks pretty good.
Yeah, I'm really impressed by him. I was someone, like Lamar Jackson was someone during the draft process who elicited very extreme opinions. There was people saying he has to be a wide receiver or running back, and there were people saying this is the next great quarterback, and I was pretty much right in the middle. I felt like I was looking at someone who could be Andy Dalton for 10 years, and that's not a bad thing. Like, if you can get a quarterback who's an average starter at the end of the first round, you won't complain. He's over-exceeded my expectations to this point. His first start, it didn't really tell us anything. Marvin Lewis didn't know how to approach him. They kept playing two-man, which two-man is when you have both safeties play deep in zone and you play man coverage underneath. And what that means is the guys underneath turn their eyes away from the quarterback and run with the man coverage. And for the quarterback, that means nobody is looking at him, and that means there's loads of space for him to run into. So he would just run into that all day, and that's why he ran 20-plus times in that game. It was game planning. And people kind of took that game and said, oh, all he can do is run, he can't pass. But then he came out in this Bengals game, and they came out in this most recent game, and while he wasn't facing a great defense again, he was able to actually push the ball and move the ball around the field as a passer. He had one big drop touchdown that was immediately before his actual touchdown throw on a slant by John Brown, and he had two phenomenal deep throws. One that came about because he diagnosed the coverage under pressure, moved in the pocket, reset to a little spot pocket of space, changed the throwing lane, all very technical, very awareness required things to do, and then hit his open receiver in stride. It should have been a long touchdown, but it was Mark Andrews, a tight end, who got caught from behind because he's obviously not a speedster as a tight end. And then the other one was negated by a holding penalty by his right tackle, an awful holding penalty. But the pass he threw on that play was perfect. The wide receiver wasn't even really open. He was just on the other side of the defender, and he dropped the ball perfectly in over his shoulder into his chest. And he had a couple of plays in that game where it was like this is technical. This is not about his athleticism. This is about him being a quarterback. And he has the ability to be a high-quality starter. He might not be one. He might not develop in the right ways. He might not ever become consistent enough. But the ability is there. The quality is there. And they just have to build him and grow that offense around him with him.
Yeah, so look, obviously, again, we don't want to overreact to a massive defeat of the Raiders because, as we said, Nick Mullins managed to do it and had, like, the greatest debut in the history of NFL and then looks like a, you know, a backup in the NFL. And a decent backup, which is completely fine for an undrafted free agent. So we'll wait and see exactly what happens with that. The interesting thing about having somebody like this come in the middle of the year where your job is basically on the line, you can go back to the guy who won you the Super Bowl, who's sitting there sticking the joint out all season, kind of, you know, being grand. But what do you, like, you've got to go with the new kid, right?
Blake Bortles got benched this week, and Blake Bortles, over recent years, the only quarterback who's statistically worse than Blake Bortles is Joe Flacco. And Joe Flacco has been skating by on this massive contract because the Ravens have been tied to him, and he's been skating by on that Super Bowl win. His career has a very, very clear arc to it. He was a solid game-managing type quarterback who didn't have to do too much, peaked at the Super Bowl year, and since then, it's been all downhill. He has become one of the worst quarterbacks in the league, and he shouldn't be starting. Lamar Jackson, with all his inconsistencies, with all his uncertainty as a rookie, is already a better quarterback than Joe Flacco. And that might seem crazy if you're just sitting back on the outside and just looking in and not really looking at him closely, but the mistakes that Flacco makes constantly in the reluctance to use his feet in the pocket, his reluctance to throw the ball properly with proper mechanics and step into his throws and deliver accurate passes, it's a major issue, and the Ravens have no future with Flacco. They have no short-term future with Flacco. They need to move forward with Jackson. They need to ride through his mistakes and just put Flacco on the back burner the same way the Cowboys did with Tony Romo a couple of years ago, even though some of us could argue that one. Tony Romo was still a high-quality quarterback. With Flacco, it's a much easier football decision. If they go back to him, it's just about the relationship there and about having Flacco being someone they love within the franchise.
Okay, Carolina are at Tampa Bay, which isn't a bad place to be going when you need to win, and they need to win. They're 6-5. They've lost 3 in a row. The last week, they were beaten at home by the Seahawks. Seahawks, a bit of a surge at the moment. But what's the story with the Panthers? Because they look like a team that has a lot of pieces and a lot of talent, really, on both sides of the ball. So why so bad? Why are they having this mini slump?
Well, it feels like they're beating themselves every week. And like the play calling this week was phenomenal. Cam Newton this week was phenomenal. But when they got to the red zone, they got within 15 yards of the goal line or 20 yards of the goal line. They just kept making mistakes. And on the opening drive, they went for it in 4th and 1, and they got stopped just short. So after going for it in 3rd and 1 as well and getting stopped just short. So Seahawks made a stand. Well done to them. Then they got stopped for a field goal. Then they got stopped for an interception. That was kind of the one mistake Cam Newton made all game. And it was just this case of them driving down the field repeatedly over and over and over again, doing so easily, and then getting stopped by kind of random occurrence things. It wasn't really that the Seahawks were stiffening as a defense. It was them kind of just getting lucky, really. But they stayed in the game. They hung in the game, and they played well enough. McCaffrey had a huge day, and he was phenomenal, especially with that long run in the middle. And he went right up the middle when the Seahawks defense opened up. But Russell Wilson was there towards the end of the game in the 4th quarter. He was outstanding, made some phenomenal throws. Looked like the Russell Wilson of old, where he was picking apart defensive tight coverage deep downfield. And he just won the game for them. And you have to give a lot of credit to the Seahawks and to Russell Wilson. I think the Panthers will be fine. They're just, this kind of happens. Like, you look at the Texans, they've gone into this massive win streak. You look at the teams kind of do this in the NFL because the season is so short. You can just get hot for a while and you can get cold for a while. The Panthers, so long as they win the games we expect them to win over the remaining season, I think they get in the playoffs and no one wants to play that team.
Yeah, both of them, really. So they're now the two playoff teams, you think, from the NFC?
I don't think so, because the Vikings are right there and they have a step up on both of these teams, I believe. And Washington is there too, and they have a step up. I know with Colt McCoy, you expect them to probably lose every game moving forward, so that might happen. But if it doesn't, these two teams are kind of fighting each other for that final spot. So the Seahawks getting that tiebreaker over the Panthers now is a huge, huge victory for them.
Yeah, pretty good. One of the things I wanted to just briefly, as an aside to all this, whenever you pick a running back early, like Carolina did with Christian McCaffrey, they get slaughtered for it, because it's like, well, the opportunity cost here is that you could have a right guard or a left guard or an offensive lineman who's going to be a centerpiece of your offense for 10 years, or you can get a defensive lineman and you get that first-round talent or a pass rusher, and you're never going to get that again. With somebody like Christian McCaffrey, who is both a receiver and a running back, and it was putting up the sort of numbers that they're putting up at the minute. Do we need to stop thinking about that whole, oh, the opportunity cost here is too much? The outcome, in this case, it turns out, seems pretty good.
I think it's already gone. Like, I think the general, like, people who are heavy on statistics in America, people who are heavy on fantasy football in America will still say that. But, like, you've got Todd Gurley, you've got Ezekiel Elliott, you've got Saquon Barkley, you've got Christian McCaffrey. They're all top picks, and they're all phenomenal, and they're all vitally important to their offenses. And the thing with McCaffrey is, he played every single snap in that game. He's on pace for 1,975 total yards this year. It's a huge number. The only reason I know it is I bet on his 2,000 yards over this year. But he's an integral part of their offense, and I would not want some rant, like, this, there was a Sports Illustrated mock draft this week, the first one I've seen all year, and the first five picks were defensive linemen, eight of the first 10 were defensive-sided players, there was a quarterback and an offensive tackle. So whoever did that mock draft either really, really loves this defensive class or does not understand where the NFL is right now. Right now, you need skill position players, you need an offensive lineman, and you kind of need a quarterback, but not as much as you used to. Defensive players, are going that way. Their value is dropping because you can't impact the game as much as the guys on offense can. And running backs, as long as you use them properly, they can maximize their input and, or their impact on your offense. The one counter to that is Leonard Fournette, a guy who was a very narrow skill set player who was really only a runner. He was the next Adrian Peterson, I guess. He doesn't really offer that kind of value because he doesn't impact the passing game. He doesn't diversify your offense. He's not a mismatch when he leaves the pocket.
I wouldn't take him. I'd like to see him with a good quarterback. The one caveat to that is, so I own him in a dynasty league and I've paid attention to almost every snap he's played. And I would just like to see him with a quarterback who can do a bit of play action and maybe take a bit of the heat off sometimes so that the box isn't, oh, you've got the running back in the backfield. I guess what, we think we have an idea what you're going to do here, Blake.
Well, that's a nice transition into the Jaguars situation because they've changed their offensive coordinator, they've benched their quarterback, and Tom Coughlin's blaming everyone around him right now for what's going on. But they built a very specific offense, so it's very hard to blame the offensive coordinator. They built a very specific offense with a bad quarterback who's proven he can't run an offense. So their offense was built around Leonard Fournette. They signed Andrew Norwell, I believe it was, in the offseason to be a run-grading blocker at left guard. And it was an offense for a different era. You can't have five receivers and it spread out over the field. You can't move Fournette around. He has to be in the backfield just running between the tackles, running off tackle. He has to be not running from shotgun because he wants that little bit of momentum to accelerate into. It's an argument, like, because I think Fournette's been a better receiving option than I expected him to be, but he's still not someone who's going to move into the slot and run a route downfield. He's not Le'Veon Bell. He's not like that. So it's an argument to be made that the situation there for Fournette hasn't maximized his output, but I still feel like he's just not that type of player.
Are there QBs in the NFL at the moment, as opposed to in the draft, that somebody like Jacksonville should be looking at? Should they be taking Teddy Bridgewater and sticking him in that team next year and also drafting so that you give yourself an option?
Yeah, well, Teddy's the obvious one. Teddy's situation is just weird because he had that massive injury. He went to the Jets and had to kind of prove his health. As soon as he proved his health, everyone realized, hey, this guy's actually really good. Let's get him in. Teddy's the obvious one. The problem, I think, is they're going to be going, like, if Tom Coughlin's still there, they'll be looking at Flacco. They'll be looking at Eli Manning. They won't be looking at Teddy. Tyrod Taylor would be a great one for them because he's basically a better version of Bortles. A really good athlete who can throw deep. You can run the same offense you want to run. The other options there, like if a guy like Ryan Tannehill comes available, Derek Carr is probably going to be available. The draft this year is supposedly bad, but we always say that at the time of the year, so I don't really put any stock in that. I think the bigger issue there is they need to kind of change the whole regime. Like, the whole identity of the offense, the whole identity of the team is built on a defense in an offensive league, and that just doesn't work.
Is there not like a counter-cyclical argument that actually last year they were really good if they were able to actually have an offense that could keep the defense off the field for more than 25 minutes a game, 35 minutes a game, then perhaps having a really good defense is the thing that's going to get a stop in games and you can be involved in shootouts?
I mean, defense matters to a degree. You still need to have guys who can make some plays. I just don't think you can shut teams down anymore the way the Steelers did 10 years ago, the way the Ravens did 10 years ago, and build victories like that. Like, if you can talk about last year, but last year was a bit of an anomaly in the regular season in the sense of how they won the closer games that they shouldn't have won sometimes. But once you got to the playoffs, you got a very, very clear example of the Jaguars were better than the Patriots. Very, very clearly better than the Patriots. But they get to the end of the second quarter and Blake Bortles takes a knee with 40 seconds left on the clock because they're so scared of their own offense. So you can have a dominant, like the Bears. If you have a dominant defense like the Bears right now and you do just enough on offense to get by, yeah, sure, that still works. You can't have like the Ravens defense with Trent Dilfer or the Tampa Bay Buccaneers defense from 15 years ago when it was Brad Johnson who was their quarterback. I don't even remember who their quarterback was. So you can't really do that anymore. You can't just dominate and focus on your defense and get parts and put missed parts together on offense and kind of try and get by like that. You need at least to be balanced. But that's also very difficult to do with how much people are paying offensive pieces now.
Yeah. We want to talk about Philip Rivers putting together like a career year in many respects, and has the Chargers at 8-3. We thought that maybe 2 weeks ago the Chargers were, you know, charging, and then last week they came out and they took care of business and it was over in the first quarter and away you go. We 24-25 consecutive completions. So, you know, come the moment where he needed to step up, he did it. Is there any sense that this is a team of destiny this year?
I think it's time for you to take your victory lap over me from the preseason where you were very high in the Chargers and I just won't trust the Chargers. I'm still reluctant to trust the Chargers.
No, it's
because.
Not done. It's not done.
And Melvin Gordon just got hurt again, so like this just keeps happening to them. Fortunately, it's an MCL, not an ACL, so he might be back at the end of the year. I think the thing that stood out for me, like, I love Philip Rivers. I'm one of the biggest Philip Rivers fans ever. But I always hate when something like this happens where he has these big, perfect stat game and it's like, oh, he was perfect, he was phenomenal, and everyone's singing his praises, and I have to kind of come in and go, he took 4 or 5 sacks, he had a couple of throws where Mike Williams did a phenomenal job adjusting to poorly placed balls, and Austin Eckler, he checked down to 11 times. That's a big part of why he had 24 or 25 completions. Obviously, played really well, really, really impressed by him. But the thing that really interests me from this weekend, so if you go back 12 years ago, Mark Brunell sets the completions without an incompletion in the first half record. He has 14 of 14, opens the game, starts like that. Cam Newton equals that record yesterday in the 1 o'clock, or on Sunday in the 1 o'clock games. Phillip Rivers then beats it 2 hours later, even though it lasted for 12 years beforehand. But then on Monday night, Marcus Mariota comes out and starts with, I think it was 13 straight completions, and finishes the game with one incompletion and one missed throw. And the interesting thing to me was Marcus Mariota and Philip Rivers played basically the same game. You could even argue Mariota was slightly better because he shouldn't have been he didn't have an interceptable pass. He didn't miss as many throws as Rivers missed. But the difference between the two games was the Titans couldn't run the ball at all, and they didn't have weapons at receiver. They only have Corey Davis, and that's it. And the framing of the two performances was Philip Rivers had this phenomenal record-breaking day, and Marcus Mariota had empty stats. That wasn't really the way that game, those two performances went. The individuals were both really good. One just had a better team, one had a worse team. But in terms of just the Chargers, I really like their offensive setup right now. Keenan Allen there, Travis Benjamin played well at the weekend. Eckler, like I talk about checking down to him, but he's been a pretty good replacement for Gordon when he's been in. Joey Bosa coming back looks like Joey Bosa. That's the best you could have asked for when you knew he was going to be out for an extended period. They are set up to be the biggest contender to the Chiefs in the AFC, I guess, but I feel like most of us expect an NFC team to win this. We expect it to be the Rams or the Saints at this point.
Yeah, I mean, I'm interested in seeing how that all plays out, and I wouldn't be terribly surprised one way or another in the end. Just on the point that you were making about Tennessee not having a running game, it seems a bit weird because they've got two running backs, both of whom you would expect are capable of being successful. Is that an offensive line issue then? Is that like just...
Well, Deion Lewis is a really, really good running back. Derrick Henry is not. Derrick Henry is basically the opposite of Deion Lewis. Deion Lewis is the small guy, really quick guy who runs really hard and is violent and really hard to tackle. Derrick Henry is massive and he doesn't run very hard. He tries to run sideways and looks for the sideline too often. But kind of getting past that, the issue there is the offensive line. And what the Titans have are offensive linemen who were drafted to be in Mike Mularkey's scheme, which was very much focused on putting the quarterback under center, running power, having extra tight ends there, and guys who would just like knock heads against each other. And what the new offense wants to do is move everyone a little bit, wants to create a little bit more space. And Jack Conklin is not built for this scheme, and he's also coming off a torn ACL. You will know who Jack Conklin is if you watch Monday Night Football, because he was the guy getting flattened by DeMarcus Lawrence over and over again, or not DeMarcus Lawrence, by J.J. Watt and Jadeveon Clowney over and over again at right tackle. And then you had Josh Klein inside of him, who is just an incompetent player, basically. Whenever he is left one-on-one with any defensive lineman, the play is destroyed, it's over. So the thing the Titans need to do is find some athletes, basically. If you look at the Rams offensive line, the Steelers offensive line, you have guys who are big bodies, who are comfortable moving in space, who can move sideways, who can move forward, who can latch onto bigger bodies and move them out of the way. The Titans just don't have any of that. They don't have any impact blockers. You can add to, like, maybe Taylor Lewan, you will add, is an okay player. He's fine. He's overpaid, but he's good enough to start at left tackle. Outside of him, you need a new left guard. You need a new center. You need a new right guard. You need a new right tackle. And this was kind of an issue with Mularkey, was he would sign a guy like Ben Jones at center, and he would overrate Ben Jones when he wasn't an impact blocker and he wasn't a consistent blocker, and you kind of wonder what value you're getting, and now you're seeing the impact of that in the new offense.
Yeah, you can totally see the impact that the offensive line has had on Seattle, for example. We talked a bit about that earlier on. One last thing that I wanted to ask you about was the surge that we've seen in the last couple of weeks from Denver and the form of Houston. How real are these two things?
That's a play in the AFC does feel. I think they're real in the sense that they can sustain. Denver in particular has a very easy schedule, if I'm not mistaken. I think they get to play the Cardinals and the Raiders, and they played the Raiders only once so far. The Texans, I think, are quite a good team. The big key in that Monday Night Football game was Mike Vrabel was the former defensive coordinator of the Texans. So the Texans used to have a really good defense. They brought in Mike Vrabel, and they suddenly started making all these mistakes. Guys were out of position. Guys were blowing coverages. And it happened in that, for that Jonnu Smith touchdown against the Titans. It happened once, but it wasn't a consistent trend throughout the game. But when they had Mike Vrabel as their defensive coordinator, it was just a constant mess. You have Mike Vrabel leave before the start of the season, and the defense gets a lot better. Those mistakes disappear. The alignments are fine. Players are being used properly. And you look at the other side of that ball, the Titans are having all these issues now on defense. So it's one of these things, it's a very simple kind of logic where Vrabel's there and Vrabel's gone, and these two things are happening at the same time or different times. But it's a bit of a trend that needs to be watched over. I think the big positive for the Texans is that division is pretty much theirs to win. The Colts are obviously a contender, but they started as bad as the Texans did, and it feels like the Texans are a better team than the Colts, so I would expect them to win more games towards the end of the regular season. I don't feel like either the Broncos, the Texans, and I'm going to throw the Colts in there as well, I don't feel like any of them are actual contenders for a Super Bowl, but they're definitely playoff teams at this point.
All right, good stuff, Cian. Thanks for joining us this week. Cheers, man.
Thanks, man.
Cian Fahey giving us some thoughts there, and you should check out his Patreon if you want some more detail for the analysis and the breakdown and the type of stuff that Cian's talking about there. Sue not with us this week, she's off sick, but her picks, she's taking the Panthers, she says they have to win, the Colts, the Jags took out Bortles, and the Chiefs, massive spread, but I think they'll do it. Total so far is 12 out of 16, got the Dolphins right last week, the Eagles won but didn't beat the spread, and the Steelers were idiots is the exact quote here. So I'm just going to check the spreads on those, taking the Panthers because they have to win, and the Panthers are -3.5 at Tampa Bay. That sounds about right. Taking the Indianapolis Colts at the Jacksonville Jaguars, the Colts -4. Who knows what the replacement of the QB is going to do in that one. And then the Chiefs are -15.5, 11-10 at the Raiders. That's not a bad bet at all. That's our lot this week. We'll be back next week. Thanks a million. Cheers.